Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio in St. Louis is
Joe Manis.
And our guest this week,
John Hancock,
the chairman of the Missouri Republican Party, not the founding father of America.
That is correct.
Thank you very much for joining with us today. He's been in the news a lot recently for various reasons, which we're going to get into in more depth. But, you know, people may just see the name John Hancock in the newspaper or on television or on the radio on other competing stations, but they may not know who the person is. So we are going to continue with our normal trajectory here in Politically Speaking and kind of ask you about your background and how you got into politics.
Yeah, so to give people a sense of who you are, especially people who are younger than me.
Yeah, well, I started getting interested in politics when I was a kid, and 13 years old. My neighbor was running for state representative, and I helped him with
his
campaign.
Now, where'd you live at the time?
I lived in Willowbrook subdivision, a sort of unincorporated north of Creve Coeur, south of Maryland Heights.
So, was that the Chesterfield area by any chance?
No, it was right Schutz Road and Schutz and Lindbergh.
Okay, you know, so that's kind of near Maryland Heights, around in there.
Yeah, right. Strike and Spare Bowling Alley was where I hung out, and which I think they've torn down now. But anyway, that's we're getting a little far afield.
They probably put up an outlet mall there.
They did, and so I was also very passionate about ragtime piano as a young man. I played. I read every book about Scott Joplin that had ever been written, and there weren't many at that time. And I knew several of his compositions, started composing some myself, and there was an article in the Post-Dispatch in 1977 written by Joe Manis.
This is a true story, folks.
Yeah, about the Scott Joplin House had been put on the National Register of Historic Sites, and the Board of Aldermen had appropriated, in the city, had appropriated $100,000 to basically stabilize the structure because it was falling down.
Now, they had gotten some federal money.
Yeah.
This is back in the day when there was more federal money floating around.
Right. And so the mayor at the time, Jim Conway, vetoed the appropriation, and the Board of Aldermen overrode the veto, and he still wouldn't release the money. And Joe Manis was reporting because she was covering the City Hall beat at that time. So one of the things that the mayor said is that Joplin only lived in the house for 2 weeks. And I knew that was wrong. I'd read his biography. In fact, he wrote The Entertainer in that house. So I started calling the mayor's office, and they wouldn't call me back. And I was in the Boy Scouts, and so I ran and got myself elected county executive for the day. And so I'm probably 14 years old by this point.
Who was county executive?
Gene McNary. And so I spent a day with Gene McNary and gave him an earful about Scott Joplin. And at the lunch, the mayor for the day was there, and Mayor Conway was there. So I went up to Mayor Conway and told him, you know, you're wrong about Scott Joplin, sir. And so he eventually had his office call me, and they didn't want to release the funds because they didn't want it going to the Jeff Vanderloo Neighborhood Association because they were in some kind of a squabble.
Yeah.
And so I went and met with Jeff Vanderloo, and then my state representative put me in touch with the State Division of Historic Preservation. I put them in touch with Jeff Vanderloo, and they worked out a deal where the state took over the property. The city released the money. The state put some money in. There was some federal money, and I think Jack Daniel's Distillery put some money in.
Yes, they did.
And I got my name in the paper when I was 15 or 16 years
old. Yeah, you were about 15. Yeah. And I remember, because I covered the Board of Aldermen at the time, very young, and they had you stand in the balcony. The balcony now is closed and rarely used, but the Board of Aldermen has this balcony. And I remember that they had you standing in the balcony when we did like a final vote and stuff. And our photographer took some pictures.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a little bit.
Yeah, right. That's a long story.
I guess you rode this fame to being a state representative. And is that correct?
Well, sort of.
There was a gap.
I had to.
You became the first 17-year-old state representative.
I had to get out of middle school first. But I actually went to college. I did some internships in Jeff City, and I was going to be a college professor, and I was working on a PhD, and my state representative retired, and I was 23, 24 years old.
Who was your state rep at the time?
George Hoblitzer.
Okay.
He was from Ladue. And so I ran for state representative as a 24-year-old, and ironically, my Democratic opponent was also a 24-year-old
guy. Wow.
a guy named David Cass, who today I think works for the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I ran into him on the street in D.C. a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So, and I served two terms then in the legislature, ran for Secretary of State in 1992, lost to Judy Moriarty.
Yeah. let's talk about that for
race.
A moment.
I
because
that, race.
That was kind of the quintessential example of why 1992 was a massive wave Democratic year.
Well, first, let me explain a little bit, because I'd covered this race. There, in 1992, there was a whole passel of candidates on both sides, but especially the Democratic side, that were running for various offices. So there were four Democrats who were running for the nomination for Secretary of State, and a state rep named Bob Quinn was supposed to win.
Bob Quinn,
I mean, let's put it this way. The establishment assumed he was going to win. Mm-hmm. And then a couple other, and then there was also a struck off.
We had a four-way primary.
Yeah, on your side. That's how I was switching. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans also had a crowded primary. So, but the bottom line was, Judy Moriarty on the Democratic side, no one expected her to win.
Yeah.
But she was the only woman in a four-person Democratic field. She won. They were all shocked.
Yeah,
shocked.
She raised...
Mel Carnahan was the gubernatorial nominee, and they were all trying to figure out what to do with her because they hadn't expected her to win.
Yeah.
She wasn't part of the establishment. So on the Republican side, it was John Hancock. And actually, the first time I went to interview him, this is what, 15, 16 years after Scott Joplin.
Yeah.
And I was not even thinking about him being the same person or anything.
But it was.
I walked into his house, and I walked into your office, and he had this article framed. It's a big frame picture of the article about him in the Scott Joplin house. And I remember turning to him and saying, oh my gosh, you're the kid.
Yeah.
So anyways.
Yeah, I used to be young.
Yeah. You ended up losing that race kind of unexpectedly because it was not for anything that you did most likely, but because it was a terrible year for Republicans.
Because they're starting to beat a Clinton wave at the end and
Perot was running that year for president. So I think George H.W. Bush got 38% in the state.
Yeah, it was not a good year to be a Republican.
Webster got 39 or 40%, and I lost by 1%. I led the ticket, which is woohoo.
And then 4 years later, you ran again
against
Becky Cook. It was actually a pretty close race, even though she was the quote-unquote incumbent, because, spoiler alert, Judy Moriarty got impeached from office for, I guess, letting her son file for something after a deadline.
Yeah.
Then you kind of transitioned into kind of more behind-the-scenes role. You were the executive director of the Republican Party for a number of years, and you had a consulting company. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So, after I lost the second time.
This is 96.
Yeah, 96. My wife was 8 months pregnant with our second kid. I didn't have a job. I had two mortgages, and we were broke. So I was going to go get a job. You know, it was time to grow up and get a job. And the chairman of the state party at that time was Woody Kozad.
Yeah, a lawyer from the Kansas City area.
Kansas City. And I had shared with him some of my concerns about the state of the state party. And I had really kind of seen in my brief time in politics that the Democrats had sort of gained a tactical advantage over us in the way they were targeting and so forth. So he asked me if I would come be the executive director. And I said, yeah, I mean, that's they paid me money and I could do politics. And so I enjoyed that. I had run some campaigns in 1994 in between my two Secretary of State's races. And 94 was a good Republican year. We won them all. So I came to the party. I think we did a very good job at the party under Woody Kozad and then Ann Wagner as the chairman. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that a lot. And in 2004, after Matt Blunt's election as governor, I went out on my own and started my own consulting business.
Yeah. Let's fast forward a little bit because you have a long and storied history. We could go through every campaign that you run since then. But let's just skip to, mid-February.
Yeah.
Let's go back a few months earlier because I think that kind of then fits in. You decided last fall to run for the state party chairman. Now, just so our listeners understand, the state party chairman in both state parties, they don't make any money. They're not paid.
It's an unpaid position.
It is a volunteer job.
It would be essentially like if Jeff Rowe decided to be a Republican party chairman, a consultant going to a non-paid leadership role.
So what made you decide to do this? We're talking like last fall when some of this stuff started.
Well, so much of my professional career was spent building the Missouri Republican Party. And we were When I left there, we were considered one of the top state party organizations in the country, and we really were doing some amazing things. And it had definitely fallen into some disrepair over the years, and the last couple of years were particularly rough just on the fundraising side. And I continued raising the money for the party after I left. I was a vendor. They paid me to raise their money. So really for 16 years, I was the fundraiser for the state Republican Party. And so we looked at one of the state committee members had called one of my researchers in Ohio and asked him to look into the party's fundraising performance. And he did. And I looked at it and I thought, I think we could do better than this. And so I had never entertained the idea before, but I talked to a couple of state committee members, and they seemed receptive to me running, and so I decided I'd do it because I wanted to fix the Republican Party.
Now, the chairman, this is true of both parties, while it's unpaid and they oversee things, they really, both parties have executive directors which is what you had done in the 90s. So
right.
Go on.
Yeah. But then it was initially a situation where Ed Martin, who was the Republican Party chairman at the time, was, for a time, still thinking of running for another term. He obviously backed out and is now with the Eagle Forum.
Yeah. Great position for him.
Yeah. And then you ran against two other people, but you ended up winning pretty decisively. I don't even think it was really that close.
No, it wasn't. He got 50 votes. One of them got 7. Another one got 11.
Yep.
So that was February 21st.
Yes.
At Lincoln Days.
Right.
I think about 5 or 6 days later, Tom Schweik, the state auditor, commits suicide.
Yeah.
And then starts kind of a flood of criticism your way. So, Joe, can you just summarize what happened to John Hancock after Schweik's suicide?
Okay, now, one of the things that had been going on, but frankly, I had never even heard of it. There was, until Schweik's suicide, most reporters hadn't really heard anything about the alleged whispering campaign having to do with whether or not he was Jewish. I mean, I'm simplifying it.
Yeah.
Schweik was not Jewish. He was Episcopalian. His father and grandfather were Jewish. This had not been mentioned. I had not heard that much. What I had heard was that Schweik had not been happy with you because you had been doing work for Catherine Hanaway, who was the other major Republican candidate who'd announced for governor. Now, you had announced at the committee meeting right before you were elected, you promised that you wouldn't work for any Missouri candidates, do any consulting work.
In
primaries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right after that, there was an election for vice chairman, and Schweik's chief of staff, Trish Vincent, lost. Okay, a few minutes later, there is a straw poll of the 68 executive committee members, and Schweik also loses. Hanaway wins. Okay, so then you fast forward a few days. There began to be rumors, like 48 hours later, late Monday night. In fact, I talked to you.
Mm-hmm.
That Schweik was going to be talking about this alleged whispering campaign. He was supposed to have a news conference on Tuesday. This was would have been the 24th.
Yep.
It didn't happen. You sent your wife to Jeff City in case it did.
Right. My wife and I both went.
Yeah. Danforth has said, this is former Senator John Danforth, who I also covered for a long time, who is Schweik's mentor, had talked to him Tuesday night and talked him out of it, saying, you know, that he thought the better way was to talk to some reporters privately about this. Okay, so then Thursday morning, Vincent calls Danforth's office. She's concerned about Schweik's state of mind. Danforth's chief assistant, Martha Fitz, gets Schweik and his wife on the phone. She's on the phone with Schweik. Then he gets off. His wife's on the phone, and he shoots himself. And right before he died, he was talking about this alleged whispering campaign.
Now that we're in context, you have strenuously denied that you were involved in any anti-Semitic, bigoted campaign against Tom Schweik. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In fact, I'm going to read you an exact quote that you put out right afterward.
Okay.
You said, and this is from the Casey Star, John Hancock said that he mistakenly believed that Schweik was Jewish, quote, but it was simply a part of what I believed to be his biography, no different than the fact that he was from St. Louis and had graduated from Harvard Law School. That is what you said. Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you come to the mistaken conclusion that Schweik was Jewish?
You know, I've given that some thought. It's just stupidity. I guess I just assumed that he was Jewish.
Was it because of his name?
Yeah, was it because his last name sounded Jewish?
I don't know. I you know, it's stupid. It's sometimes you think you know something, you know. I just don't know why I would have thought that, but I did.
Here's why I asked that question. There have been three Jewish people who have been elected to statewide office: Kenneth Rothman, yep. Harriet Woods, and Jason Kander.
Yeah.
All three of them are Democrats. I would imagine, since you're in opposition research, that if a Republican who was Jewish had been elected to statewide office, it probably would have been noted by the press almost immediately, because it would have been a first. It would have been the same thing if an African-American had won statewide office. It would have been if, you know, let's go back to Margaret Kelly, for example. It was the first time a woman became in statewide office.
Right.
It just seems like that would have been a widely known fact if he was Jewish, especially to somebody who is in opposition research. Is that a fair assessment to do?
I suppose. I just don't think somebody's religion is that big of a deal. I mean, it's not something that I consider. I don't ask my clients what religion they are. It's just not a big deal to me. And the fact that I thought Tom was Jewish, I would never have said that to somebody in a way that would be hurtful, because I don't consider that to be a negative thing at all.
Well, there was one person who did think it was hurtful, and that's former U.S. Senator John Danforth.
Right.
He didn't mention you by name in his homily, but he mentioned this quote-unquote whispering campaign.
Tom called this anti-Semitism, and of course it was. The only reason for going around saying that someone is Jewish is to make political profit from religious bigotry.
And apologies to our listeners for the echo. That was the best audio that we could get. But, I mean, you obviously have heard that before. What's kind of your response to Senator Danforth on that?
Well, if somebody's running around doing a whisper campaign, that is wrong. And there's no place for it in politics. And if you're running around, you know, denigrating somebody's religion, then that's wrong. So I don't disagree with Jack Danforth's assessment of right and wrong politics. I vehemently disagree with that. I'm an example of something that was wrong, because there was no whisper campaign. And, you know, a whisper campaign would mean there would be dozens of people out there saying, yeah, Hancock was in and telling me Schweik was. It just didn't happen. There was no whisper campaign.
Now, what you had said to me, and I've printed this a couple times,
yeah,
was that in September, when you were David Humphreys,
right,
who's a major donor from the Joplin area, that you and some other people were in a meeting, and that it was in the context of discussing how religion might affect voter turnout.
Right.
And Hanaway is Catholic.
Yep.
And what you had told me was that it was discussing whether or not, you know, how much of the Catholic vote she could get, or whether or not it was even relevant, whether or not her being Catholic would affect anything.
Right.
And so you're saying, you have said that any comment about Schweik was in the context of that broader discussion, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and that was in September.
Yeah, I was working on a project called Missouri Catholic Vote. It is, well, it's not my belief, it's a fact, that the largest identifiable demographic of ticket splitters, swing voters in Missouri, is Catholic voters, identified Catholics. And they swing wildly. And one of the points that I was making in the context of this project that I was working on is that just the fact that a candidate is Catholic is no guarantee that they win the Catholic vote. And I would point to the Ed Martin, Chris Koster race for Attorney General in 2012, where
Martin, who's Catholic,
who, yeah, worked for the Archdiocese. I think he worked in the Vatican.
Yes,
at
he
one
did.
Point. And yet he lost the Catholic vote overwhelmingly to Chris Koster in that election. So I would be making a point that even though Catherine Hanaway is Catholic and Tom Schweik is Jewish, that's no guarantee that the Catholic vote is going to go in that direction. That would have been the kind of point I was making.
Yeah, and I guess in that situation, because, and I'm not trying to be stereotypical here, but I think there's been polling that shows that American Jews tend to vote for the Democratic Party more than the Republican Party, you know, just because, and again, you mistakenly thought that Tom Schweik,
right,
was Jewish. I guess the point that you were making is just because he was Jewish doesn't mean that a lot of Jewish people would vote for him, probably because he was a Republican or something along that line.
Yeah, lines. And I just don't consider somebody's religious affiliation to be that big of a deal. I mean, it, you know, it certainly, I would never have gone around trying to discredit Tom Swyke by telling people he was Jewish. That wouldn't, you know.
Well, I'm going to play another clip from Senator Danforth where he kind of explains why this might have been a hurtful situation.
When was the last time anyone sidled up to you and whispered into your ear that such and such a person is a Presbyterian? Tom told me of his Jewish grandfather who taught him about anti-Semitism and told him that any time Tom saw it, he had to confront it.
Now, there have been a couple of articles that have come out since Tom Swyke's suicide explaining how in Missouri, while there may not be rampant, latent anti-Semitism going along, and I mean, spoiler alert to our listeners, I'm a Jewish American, you can probably tell by my last name.
I wouldn't assume that.
I don't think you can assume that anymore.
Yeah. Right.
I haven't experienced like a lot of blatant anti-Semitism living in Missouri for the last 10 years, but it did explain that since Missouri is an overwhelmingly either Protestant or Catholic state, it's kind of difficult sometimes for a Jewish candidate to break through. I mean, Kenneth Rothman ran for governor in 1984. It was a terrible Democratic year, and there were probably extenuating circumstances. But, I mean, I've heard from some people who knew Kenneth Rothman that said that his Judaism was somewhat of a liability in the rural areas. So I think that's what Senator Danforth was saying, that, you know, whether we like it or not, this type of thing exists among some people and some voters,
I'm sure it does, but it's not a – I don't think I know a single person that I'm an acquaintance with that I would consider anti-Semitic. I don't think I know anybody. And the Republican Party at its base is, at least in Missouri, is made up with a lot of evangelical Christians.
Correct.
And you're not going to find on the planet more passionately pro-Israel people than evangelical Christians, which form really the core and the base of the Republican grassroots out there. So they're just it just is not true that there's some widespread anti-Semitism strain flowing through the Republican Party. It's not there.
Well, and even and to be fair, back in 1984 when Rothman won, that was a huge Republican year. Ronald Reagan carried every state.
There were extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, so I think sometimes in politics, and this is true of both parties sometimes, where they blame something, a huge loss, on some factor that actually there may have been
I'm not saying that was the main factor, but it may have been one factor.
Correct, but you are correct, though, that people were blaming the fact that he was Jewish, saying that may have hurt him, when in fact it might not have mattered.
I represented my home state representative district was Creve Coeur, Olivet, and Ladue. I had a large Jewish population in that district when I got elected twice to be its representative. And one of the things I explained to Jack Danforth last November is that if I were anti-Semitic, I've been active in politics for 30 years. I represented Creve Coeur, Olivet, and Ladue in the General Assembly. If I was an anti-Semite, somebody would have pointed that out by now.
And this may be more of a question for Jack Danforth or the other people who have opined on it, but you know, I've noticed from an outside perspective, Joe has been writing most of the story, that a lot of people opining on what is anti-Semitic and what is not, you know, it's been a lot of, you know, non-Jewish people basically talking about this, including Senator Danforth.
Yeah.
I know that he has a degree in theology and he probably understands religion, but
he's
fact remains
minister.
He's not Jewish.
Right.
He doesn't understand the Jewish experience and he doesn't understand what perks people's mind what anti-Semitism is.
Right.
I mean, have you noticed that throughout this entire situation
This whole thing has been, it's been a mess. And, you know, it started when the Post-Dispatch editorial page decided that Tom Swyke's off-the-record comments were newsworthy without verifying the accuracy of it. And if they would have done the good reporting work on the front end, there was no whisper campaign. The police have said it now. I've said it. There was no whisper campaign. And the Post-Dispatch essentially said it in their news department when they wrote the piece, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. So if they would have done that good work on the front end and tried to get a second source to verify any of these things, then none of this would have happened.
Why have you decided not to resign after the calls for resignation?
Because I didn't do anything wrong. And I want to do this job. 50 out of 68 people selected me to do this job. I spent 3 months campaigning for it, and I know I can do a good job for the Republican Party. And I didn't do anything to merit my resignation.
Is some of this about your reputation as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is going through something like, I've been around a long time, you know, and I've worked with a lot of people and done a lot of things. And I think generally folks, they may not think I'm very effective, some, but I don't think anybody thinks I'm a bad person. And this is the first time in my life that I've had my character attacked like this.
Have you lost a lot of business? Have you lost a lot to your reputation?
I think my reputation has taken some damage through all of this, yeah.
So I kind of want to move on a little bit.
Me
because
too.
I'm sure you do. Before Schweik's suicide, there was this ad, which I want to emphasize to both our guest and our listeners. John Hancock did not have anything to do
with
it. He was not responsible for it. But I'm playing it because it was kind of a sense of what the discourse was in the Republican Party.
Sure.
Like very far out into the primaries.
Now, this was done by a group that led by allies of Hanaway, but Catherine Hanaway also has denied any connection with this ad. I want to make sure.
So let's play a little bit of clip of that ad.
Tom Schweik, like him? No. Is he a weak candidate for governor? Absolutely. Just look at him. He could be easily confused for the deputy sheriff of Mayberry. But more importantly, he can be manipulated. That's why Senator Claire McCaskill and President Obama enlisted my help to meddle in another Republican primary with Schweik as our pawn.
Okay, so first of all, I'm not trying to opine here. I'm just using this as an analysis from looking at other ads. That ad is by no means the nastiest ad I've ever seen. If you looked in St. Louis County last year,
right.
Steve Stanger was literally, and I'm not even paraphrasing, literally said that he blamed victims of sex trafficking for their plight.
So, I mean, he was accused of saying that.
That was literally what happened in the ad, and that type of thing is far beyond what you just heard.
And what you just heard was a parody, and I think... If you're not familiar with House of Cards.
And that was not Kevin Spacey. It was somebody
imitating
Kevin Spacey.
And I don't watch House of Cards. I've never seen it. But if you've never seen House of Cards, and that ad hits you as pretty nasty.
Yeah.
But it's a parody of this character in House of
Cards.
But
that was what I was going to say next.
Yeah.
Because it has been held up as a showcase as how deep, wrong the discourse in the state has gone. And that other example I gave with Stanger against Dooley could be another example. I mean, what does it say about the discourse in your party when candidates have to go against somebody's appearance and make a pretty far-flung accusation that Claire McCaskill is manipulating him because Schweik donated $500 in 2001, basically.
So I will tell you, I've got another example of this kind of thing. I did some work for Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, in his first campaign in 2010. And he was criticized. They were making fun of his appearance and that he was a geek and a nerd or whatever. And that was a narrative that his opponents were trying to shop around. And what Rick Snyder did was he embraced that and he created a pack called One Tough Nerd. And he went on television and said, yeah, I'm a nerd. I'm going to clean up Michigan politics. And he took that, what had been a slight against him, and he embraced it and used it for his benefit. And, you know, candidates, you can do that when somebody maybe goes too far against you. You know, look for a way to use that information.
Because when I first heard that ad, I actually heard it on the 21st.
Yeah.
My first reaction is this just shows actually Schweik's strength as a candidate, because what they are attacking him on is very, very minuscule compared to what they might attack Hanaway on, considering she's voted on a bunch of things.
Right.
If you have to go so deep into the well to attack somebody's appearance in an ad and make that a central aspect, it's kind of a sign there's not much else to attack there.
I wasn't sure how – I thought it might have been somewhat experimental. Just to kind of see what sort of impact it had, because frankly, like you said, I think for the average person, you know, because most people don't watch House of Cards,
right.
and they're listening to something, they're probably not even quite sure what it's saying or not saying. It's early. I figured, as I said, because it was so early, that it was a test. A test thing.
The reason I brought it up was, you know, that was the state of your party before February 26th.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot has changed, and people are still really upset about various things surrounding Schweik's suicide.
Yeah.
As party chairman, how do you kind of lead this party toward, you know, a better tone than what you had heard before?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, that the tone of that race, which was only a month or so old at that point, it was already pretty nasty.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize, I mean, Schweik gave as good as he got.
I think that, yeah, absolutely.
And I want to, I think in some ways that's gotten lost in this, and yeah. I mean this as a respect to him. Tom Schweik was prepared to run a pretty tough, aggressive campaign. I covered his kickoff.
Oh, yeah.
And he minced no words about his concerns about Hanaway's donations from Sinkfeld, what he felt was Koster's corruption. That's the exact word that he used.
Yeah.
He said, I think that Hanaway was bought and paid for by
yeah.
Rex.
Correct.
Yeah.
So that, the tone of that was...
My point being is that he was being assertive, like most candidates for governor tend to be pretty assertive.
Yes.
I want to make
right.
that clear.
But yeah, continue. I want to hear about what you're going to do.
So the difference, anytime you've got a two-way primary, or it's just two candidates, those tend to become extremely nasty because it's a, you know, it's a family fight inside the family. We don't know yet what the ultimate field's going to look like on the Republican side for governor, but my sense is that it's going to be multi-candidate.
Yeah, and that's could be another concern.
No, that's a good thing.
It's a good thing?
It's a good thing, because if you've got a multi-candidate field out there, it fundamentally changes the whole tone and tenor of the dialogue that takes place. You'll have contrast advertising and so forth, but it's not gonna get so personal when you've got three or four candidates in a field. When I ran in a four-way primary, when that thing was over, we were all friends, all of us, but oftentimes in a two-way primary, and sometimes there may be a third or fourth candidate, but they're minor figures, and so when there's clearly two, that's when things get really nasty. You look at Carnahan Schemel, you look at Webster Blunt. Anytime you've had
Steelman Holsoff.
Anytime you have these two-way primaries, they get pretty.
So before you ask your question, okay. Joe, you expect like Senators Mark Parson and Mike Kehoe to possibly get into this race along with Hanaway and David Gretens and Randy Ashbery.
Eric Gretens.
I apologize, Eric Gretens.
And you could see Lieutenant Governor Kinder hop in. I mean, it is a wide open environment right now. And from my position as a party chairman, I'm very encouraging to anybody that wants to step in.
Now, the dynamics in a multi-person primary when there's more than two is complicated. All you have to look is that the Iowa Democratic primary for president back in 2004, where Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean were engaging in this, they were basically behaving like they were the only two.
Yep.
And the result was that John Kerry ended up coming in.
Yep.
That's one of the examples that is used by candidates in multi-candidate primaries is how not to do it. Don't get focused too much on one of your opponents because then you're allowing a third or fourth person to come around.
If there's all these candidates and they all kind of spend all of their money during the primary and Chris Koster has raised $10 gazillion and
not
then gets,
yet. We don't know yet.
And then gets $30 million from the Democratic Governors Association, I mean, is the Republican candidate going to be at a disadvantage or are they going to get like $30 million from the Republican Governors Association?
Well, the presidential cycle does not contain a lot of gubernatorial elections across the country.
Missouri's one of the few.
And so we will be a focus. This race will be a focused race, targeted race by the Democrats and Republicans nationally. And I do think that we've got an excellent chance to beat Chris Koster with any of a number of candidates. And I think Chris Koster's record has not really been fully discussed in the public just yet.
You mean that he doesn't support campaign finance limits and voted, you know, for voter ID and Medicaid cuts and all that sort of stuff?
That's part of the record.
Yeah.
But his record has not been fully discussed in a contrast way. And I don't think it will stand up very well to that kind of scrutiny, and I think a Republican's going to win.
So you're implying that any ads that are run are going to be a lot tougher than Howard House of Cards ad. Now, one of the things that I th- think that has been missed by this is that Schweik's death left his campaign with a bank balance of roughly about $1.3 million, I think, as of the last campaign finance report. It's my understanding, because Missouri does not have campaign donation limits, that the campaign can either dole it out to various candidates. They can give it a lump sum to one candidate.
Yep.
And what I've been hearing for weeks, actually, is that one of the enticements of some of the people looking at potentially running for governor is perhaps getting the support of the Schweik campaign and getting this $1.3 million block.
Have you heard anything about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the buzz and scuttlebutt and so forth.
So,
you know, the other possibility is that some of the donors may ask for their money back. You know, that's another thing. And the campaigns, I would think it would be proper in a circumstance like this to go to those donors and ask them if they would like to have their
so
money.
As party chairman, how are you going to deal with that? Because this is an unusual situation where you have a campaign committee where the candidate is deceased.
Right.
And they've got all this money, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. And, of course, they're not necessarily on friendly terms with you. Could there be, like, a third party brought in to figure out what to do with this money or what?
It's the prerogative of that apparatus. The treasurer of that committee
is
Joe Passanese,
right.
and it's his prerogative what to do with that money. And my interest as party chairman is that whatever they do with it, they need to do it legally. But so far as what they do with it is it's their business. You know, the job of the party chairman is to elect the Republican nominee. It's not to get involved in a primary and pick sides and tell people they can't run. That's not the job of the party chairman.
I wanted to segue to that really quickly because we're running a little short on time. Because one of your major campaign planks was that the Republican Party under Ed Martin wasn't raising enough money, and that even though, you know, it was a very successful election cycle. I mean, legislatively, there are no Democrats in Northeast Missouri anymore. Places like Howard County and Saline County and Jefferson County have almost total Republican delegations, which probably was unthinkable in the 1990s or even the 2000s, to be honest.
I thought it could happen.
But, you know, your argument was that the lack of money going into the party was a liability going into 2016. Why?
Right.
Why is that?
Well, because the party's job is to do the groundwork, the grassroots, the voter ID, the voter turnout, all of the things that campaigns say they're going to do, but they really don't. They really put their money into advertising and voter contact that way. So the groundwork is the job of the party, and we had done some really good and effective things in turning our vote out. And Republican politics much different than Democrat politics. Democrat groundwork is geographically centered in some very densely populated areas, and the base vote for the Democrat is relatively easy to turn out. For the Republicans, our base vote is geographically, they're spread out far and wide. There are no 90% Republican precincts, or very few of them, in the state. And so it's a more difficult and challenging task to get the Republican vote out on election day. And if you do it well, you can make a 2 or 3 or 4 point difference in the statewide vote totals.
One of the counterarguments to that would be that since campaign finance limits are no more, and that campaigns effectively operate more autonomously from the state party because they can raise lots of money.
Sure.
That having, you know, a state party flush with cash is not as important as it was when you were your executive director
right.
in 1997 to 2003. In fact, you know, I was going to play a clip from Jack Cardetti, who basically made the point that a lot less money goes through each of the parties now. I'm sure the Democrats are facing a similar situation. So how do you respond to an argumentation like that?
Well, I don't think any of us needs to worry that the Republican Party is going to suddenly be flush in cash. I don't think that's something. We need to raise enough money to operate an effective grassroots turnout program. And it's not a ton of money, but it is some money. And we need to be able to do that effectively to identify our voters and make sure they get to the polls on election day. And that doesn't take a ton of money. But it takes money, and I'm confident that we can raise enough to put a very good ground program in place.
Yeah, because one of the things from this is for both parties is that if you don't have the state parties running these grand games, you basically have duplicate operations by all the major candidates. So especially if you're dealing with a crowded field for governor, you're going to have the U.S. Senate on the ballot, and that will obviously be Roy Blunt as the Republican
And then you have a lot of
nominee.
Open races for down ballot.
Yeah,
and,
well,
and
you've got five other states.
Well, yeah, and you've got
Lieutenant
Eric Schmidt,
Governor's
who's got a
not
lot of money.
Necessarily open until until Kinder decides not to run for it.
Right.
So,
right.
Well, and you don't know because he has told me. Of course, this was at Lincoln days where he said he was definitely running for re-election, but that was before all this. But my point is does the state party then have to spend more time explaining to the candidates what's in their financial best interest? I mean, I noticed that in 2012, at least on the Democratic side, the candidates, including McCaskill, ended up giving some money to the state party, and that's basically why they were doing it, to basically fund the state party's GOTV effort.
Yeah.
Now, do you expect to see that on the Republican side this time, or are you taking a different tack?
Well, we'll see. We will cross that bridge a year from now and see how the fundraising's going, and I think if we need that kind of support, you know, number one, the national committee has previously been very generous to Missouri Republican Party, not so much in the last 4 years, but so I think there's an avenue for resources, and I think we'll do a adequate and effective job of fundraising in the state, especially the further we get away from all of the tragedy of the last month. And so I'm confident we'll have the resources that we need, and I'm confident that we know how to put a ground program together, identify voters, and turn them out effectively. And I've actually got some really, I think, cool ideas for expanding our GOTV effort.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We are a little bit over time,
sure.
But we really thank you for coming in and giving us a discussion that is worthy of a Scott Joplin opus. Or did he do more short songs?
Well, he wrote two operas, and
there you go.
One of them is extant, and one of them is lost. But he was a genius, just a genius.
So that metaphor is apt, unlike my pronunciation of some Missouri cities. You can read all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow Joe at
Jay Manis. That's JMANNIES.
And you can follow John Hancock on Twitter at
John R. Hancock.
Thank you very much for listening, as always. We'll be back next week. Until then, so long.